I wonder if I could introduce Kathleen Raine to you. I remember one Blake scholar saying that one of the great pleasures of studying Blake was that you met all kinds of people who were very knowledgeable about him, but who were also interested in other fields of life and who had a very broad knowledge of life. And although he didn't say who he was thinking of, I'm fairly sure that he had people like Kathleen Raine in mind. She is, in fact, I believe, a botanist by training. Is that correct, Kathleen?
It was many years ago,
right, but it still serves you for Blake, I think. She is a very distinguished poetess, and she is, of course, a Blake scholar. She's written several books on Blake, of which perhaps the most extensive is a very, very rich and illuminating book called Blake and Tradition. We're very honoured and pleased to have us to have her with us today. Kathleen.
Thank you. Well, I spent all last night wishing I'd brought a different paper because I realise I have a very distinguished audience and the paper I've brought is in fact a very elementary one. And I couldn't go home in the middle of the night as I would have done if I'd had wings and change this for another paper. This was one I was asked to write on a conference on the city in Dallas, Texas, of all places. And I thought, well, you know, Blake is the great poet of the city of London, and I thought, you know, Coventry, Warwick, Birmingham, the city. And so I brought this paper, and I offer it now in the presence of this very learned gathering. Miss Dunbar has written a book on Blake, I understand. And just please forgive me for being so elementary. I'm often accused of being too difficult, but now I've gone to the other extreme. Well, of course, Blake was a supreme poet of the city and of the Industrial Revolution, which is not to say that he liked the modern city or approved the Industrial Revolution. And in any case, this is the age of the city, the sensibility of the nation has moved from being rural to being civic. And what Blake had to say of his own city, London, must surely have significance in Warwick, Birmingham, Coventry, Leamington, and any other city. However, what he has to say about London has little to do with those matters as a town planner or a writer on buildings of architectural interest might have to tell us about London, nor indeed a historian telling of events and persons who have made the city famous. Not even Churchill's description of Thames as liquid history was Blake's theme, though that is a phrase he would surely have liked. But for Blake, a city is a living organism, a human, awful wonder of God, as he wrote. It is the inner lives of its inhabitants as these act and interact upon one another. And if this real city, composed of a myriad lives, the city of stone and brick, of streets and buildings, of palaces and churches, is only the image and realization. This for the poet is primary, the buildings secondary. Not indeed that Blake, himself a painter and engraver, was unaware of the architecture of London, and he spent as an apprentice engraver long days drawing the effigies of the royal tombs in Westminster Abbey and other buildings, and the Westminster Abbey, St. Paul's, appear frequently in his illuminated books as Westminster as his symbol for the true spiritual religion, and St. Paul's as the symbol of natural religion, deism, its contrary. But for Blake, the city is before all the inner, imaginative life, not of one, but of many minds. Its realization is the ever-changing expression of an ever-changing inner life. And for Blake, a Londoner born, his native city is above all human. I behold London, a human, awful wonder of God. He says, return, Albion, return. I give myself for thee. My streets are my ideas of imagination. Awake, Albion, awake, and let us awake up together. My houses are thoughts, my inhabitants affections, the children of my thoughts walking within my blood vessels. Albion is, of course, the collective inner national being of England, continuous through the centuries, of whom we are all ourselves minute cells in this great living organism of the nation. Throughout his life, Blake continued to listen to the unspoken thoughts of his city's collective life and to that of the giant Albion, the collective identity of the nation. And he wrote, so spoke London, immortal guardian. I heard in Lambeth shades. In Feltham, I heard and saw the visions of Albion. I write in South Moulton Street what I both see and hear in regions of humanity in London's opening streets. And not only London, but every city has its collective identity, its special human character. Verulam, Canterbury, venerable parent of men, generous immortal guardian, golden clad. For cities are men, fathers of multitudes, and rivers and mountains are also men. Everything is human, mighty, sublime. He names other cities: Edinburgh, clothed with fortitude; York, Selsey, Chichester, Oxford, Bath, Durham, Lincoln, Carlisle, Ely, Norwich, Peterborough. I'm sorry he didn't mention Warwick or it's just too bad. But I don't believe he did, and I can't think why. He should have done that. I'm told by Professor Smith that, in fact, Coventry was one of the first cities of England.
The third city
of England. Well, that was an omission on the part of our bard, wasn't it? And each of these cities has its own collective identity. These great megalopolis cities, I think they could have felt that they had lost that sense of a collective life, which I think one can still find in a university or a court or a monastic life, the sense of from which all civilization comes is such collectivity as of living minds interacting upon one another. I doubt if you would have found it in the modern city, which lacks this identity. So in the poem London, there is no description of the appearance of the city. Its essence is evoked in human terms. I wander through each chartered street near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe, in every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mind-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. And yet Blake's London was not wholly, as for that later great poet of London, T.S. Eliot, a wasteland, a scene in hell, but its life spanned the whole range of human joy and sorrow. London, in Songs of Experience, is shown, depicted in the accompanying plate, as an old man led by a little child. And Blake used the same depiction years later, illustrating the words, I see London, blind and age-bent, begging through the streets of Babylon, led by a child. His tears run down his beard. Babylon, of course, the great secular city, which he contrasts with Jerusalem, the city of the soul. Babylon is the city of Vala, the goddess, nature, the materialist mentality. Jerusalem is the inner spiritual city, the kingdom of which Blake strove to build. And he saw London even then as in the region of Babylon. It belongs to Babylon, not to Jerusalem. But nevertheless, Jerusalem is also being built in this city, which is for Blake a living spiritual entity. And he called the interior city of London Golgonooza, from the root Golgos, a skull, because the city's existence is within the human brain. Golgonooza, the spiritual fourfold London eternal, in immense labours and sorrows, ever building, ever falling. Terrible and beautiful, this interior city is a continual striving and creation. Here on the banks of the Thames, loose builded Golgonooza, outside the gates of the human heart. In fears he builded, in rage and in fury. It is the spiritual fourfold London, continually building and continually decaying, desolate. Without this informing life, no ancient monument, however architecturally beautiful, can be a city. Overnight, they don't change, but they cease to be living spiritual communities and become, again, museums. And this is a process that has gone on throughout history, always will. And it is the life that makes the city. The city of Golgonooza is fourfold because we are ourselves fourfold. A realization, of course, far older than Jung, who has in our own century made clear the fourfold nature of the human psyche in the four regions of reason, senses, feeling, and intuition. The whole mythological action of Blake's prophetic books is based on the interplay, the strife, and the harmonizing of these four mighty ones who are, as he says, in every breast, and whom he calls the four Zers, the four living creatures. Taken from the Greek of no doubt the New Testament, which he was learning before, apocalyptic creatures of the Book of Revelation, the fourfold man of Ezekiel's vision, and doubtless other sources also, like the Hindu fourfold gods, of which he knew something. In fact, it is a very ancient symbol. It isn't something that was invented by Jung. Indeed, Jung would be the last person to claim that he had invented it. But they are, as he says, in every breast, and correspond, if you like, to imaginative reality, because, of course, Blake was talking through all his writings of the world of imagination. Imagination was, for him, a structured reality. And only perhaps in our own century have we been in a position to realize what universe it is that Blake is speaking of in this fourfold universe of Golgonooza and its mandala structure, which corresponds so closely to the Holy City Revelation. Golgonooza, therefore, takes the form of what nowadays by Jung would be called a mandala, much like St. John's fourfold city of the New Jerusalem, with its gates and its sacred precinct. The gates are, of course, the four channels through which knowledge reaches us: reason, intuition, the senses, and feeling. And these gates are the gates of each individual and the gates of the city as a collectivity. Blake describes that city at great length, but never drew it in diagrammatic form. Foster Damon did so, and you can find it in his Blake Dictionary. But this flat diagram cannot, of course, actually represent the three-dimensional, and indeed four-dimensional city, with each of its four gates themselves fourfold, and the fourfold orientation is endlessly multiplied in every inhabitant and everything within the city. And we do, in fact, experience everything within the city with each of these four functions. And we should ask ourselves, indeed, are we being nourished by our cities in all these four areas, or does the city exist only in one dimension or in two? So Blake wrote, "And every part of the city is fourfold, and every inhabitant fourfold, and every pot and vessel and garment and utensil of the house, and every house fourfold. But the third gate in every one is closed, as with a threefold curtain of ivory and fine linen and ermine. The western gate, that of the senses, is closed by the physical body, the ivory bones and woven fibers of the fine linen and the ermine," which is Blake's symbolic description of the physical body, which closes us from the world. In fact, the gate of the senses has become closed to the imagination by materialist philosophy, which was, of course, Blake's great life work, was to attack materialism as he already saw it dominant in the philosophy which he identifies with Bacon, Newton, and Locke, who are still the culture heroes of our still materialist culture, which indeed may have darkened rather than become lighter since Blake's day. And that gate, he said, as a gateway of the imagination, which is the true man, the true humanity, is still closed in this city of Golgonooza, and will be so until what Blake hoped for as man's return to paradise. And when man returns to paradise, the fourth gate, that of the physical world, will again be opened as a gate to a spiritual experience, which under the materialist dominance it has ceased to be. So in this and other respects, Golgonooza differs from St. John's holy city. For Golgonooza is not the archetype of the perfection to which we hope to attain, but work in progress towards the building of Jerusalem. It is the labor of men and women in this world to realize in time an image of eternity. The holy city coming down from heaven, of course, is the archetype in eternity, which we are always in time seeking to realize, to build the outer city in the image of the inner city, or to use the phrase of A.E., the Irish mystic, to make the politics of time conform to the politics of eternity. And this has been the theme of Plato, of St. Augustine, and of Blake's own teacher Swedenborg, who also described his vision of the fourfold spiritual London, and whose description was no doubt the immediate inspiration of Blake's Golgonooza. In St. John's Holy City, which of course is also a mandala, the central symbol is a tree and a flowing river. And while in the center of Golgonooza is the palace of loss, the time spirit, surrounded by a moat of fire, there Loss labors at his furnaces to give concrete form in space and time to whatever humanity imagines. He builds and he destroys on his furnaces of creation. Loss and his emanation, Enitharmo, who is space, and perhaps the word means in harmony, they work in harmony, space and time, are the parents of all those who come into the world of generation. The male is a furnace of beryl, and the female is a golden loom. And while Los has his furnaces of creativity, Enitharmon has her looms, on which are woven the bodies, for which the generating spirits, with which she clothes the generating spirits in mortal bodies as they come into time. As Los brings them into time, into the time world, she gives them bodies in which to live in time. And Blake writes, the sons of Los clothe and feed them and provide houses and fields. For with every new birth, a new region of experience comes into being, each unique. The houses and fields which each of us in this room possess are our houses and fields. They may relate to one another's, but they are imaginative areas. With each birth, a new area is opened, a new region of imagination comes into being. With every human birth, indeed, with every bird or beast or any generated being, brings into existence with itself its own time and space. This is not at all the post-Cartesian view of an external collective time and space in which we all live. It is an inner time and space which we bring into being, and of course an inner city. We are inhabitants of our imaginative times and spaces, to which there is no end, there is no competition, there's no carving up into properties. We possess each a whole universe, not a part of a universe, and potentially are the, like Adam, the heirs of the whole creation. We can take as much of it as we are capable of being what we are. So it is this inner city with which Blake is concerned, and through the interplay of all these unique worlds, none alike, the city is built and sustained. And he writes, and every generated body in its inward form is a garden of delight and a building of magnificence built by the sons of Los. And the herbs and flowers and furniture and beds and chambers continually woven in the looms of Enitharmon's daughters in bright Cathedron's golden dome with care and love and tears. Cathedron, I think Blake is there using in the literal sense, not only that a great city will have its cathedral, it is the throne or seat in a cathedral of the bishop. But Blake writes, there is in every man a throne of God, and the divine humanity, the divine presence in each of us, should be seated on this throne in every man, bright Cathedron's golden dome. And Blake complains bitterly in his offices that this throne of God in each human being has been usurped by the goddess Nature, who is the real deity worshipped in our mistaken materialist civilization by the giant Albion. And this usurpation has made man, who should be the divine humanity, should reign in the city of Jerusalem. Instead of that, the goddess Nature rules in the city of Babylon. Cathedron is the palace of Los in Enitharmon and the place of generation of all who descend into this world. For Blake in that respect followed the Neoplatonists, believing in the pre-existence of souls, who crave to be generated so that they may have the opportunity of participating in the labours of citizens of this world towards perfection. He said to Crabb Robinson quite late in his life that an existence after death without an existence before birth is a logical total impossibility. And he, of course, believed that the soul is pre-existent and continues after the death of the physical body, which he never called the man, he always called it the garment. Truly, my Satan, art but a dunce who doth not know the garment from the man. The true man is the spiritual man, the living human spirit, soul, which was never born and which never dies, and within which all this wonderful manifestation of the world, which is given us by the work of Los and Enitharmon, who bring us into being, is continually created. We each enjoy this, well, it is really Blake's view of nature, is the Indian view of Maya, which he probably did know through the Bhagavad Gita, but for which there are many other sources. So you must always remember that he is speaking of the imaginative reality of man, and the human body, the divine body in every man, has no size. It is neither large nor small, and it is infinite and eternal. It is infinite and includes the whole cosmos, which indeed would be a view, I think, of modern physicists, that every portion of the world, the world is not made up as it used to be of separate portions. It is a totality of which every particle is, as it were, one way into that totality, so that each of us possesses this totality. And the souls who come into the world for the reasons given basically by Plotinus in his tractates on the soul, which are partly from choice, partly as a punishment for imperfections, partly in order to labor to regenerate the world. So it is at the same time a punishment, an opportunity for regeneration, and a task to build, as it says in the Lord's Prayer, thy will be done on earth, that is in the outward world, as it is in heaven, in the archetypal world. So those who come into generation are, they call them piteous passions and desires, with neither lineament nor form, for whom life in this world is the opportunity of realization. As they choose their affinities, so are they born on earth, and the opportunity is to give form, to give structure to what is otherwise just a formless desire, which each of us is, I suppose, impelled by some driving impulse of one kind or another to realize in this life, whatever it is in us to realize. In that respect, we are all obviously different. And of course, one form of this is the artist, which Blake was very aware of, that the artist is here to give form to what is otherwise not structured, but exists only as an impulse of piteous passion and desire. Also from Plato and the Platonists, Blake took the idea of the varying degrees of forgetfulness of eternity into which the generating souls fall as they come to drink the waters of Lethe, which is matter, according to this tradition, and Blake also, on entering this world. Some Blake calls sleepers, mere passion and appetite, who have no memory of their eternal nature, but are totally immersed in bodily existence. Others, and these include the poets, painters, musicians, and architects, remember eternity to a greater or a less degree, or, as we might say, perceive more clearly the inner pattern of the archetypal world of the imagination. And it is these who are able to build Golgonooza according to that pattern laid up in heaven, as Plato says, heaven being, as the Gospel also teaches, within, of course. Within what? That is a mere symbol, because it's not, of course, conceivable to think it's the soul within the body, but the soul being not located in space or time at all. Works of art are copies of the archetype, and in turn serve to awaken and remind the sleepers, who cannot themselves perceive, or in Platonic terms, remember the originals, and hence the necessity that there should be such works, which are necessary in order to prevent the human race from sinking into what Blake calls the deadly sleep of forgetfulness of our true, that is to say, our spiritual nature. The Jewish Christian tradition regards the fall of man as sin, but the Platonic tradition regards it as a forgetfulness, and Blake totally in this respect follows the Platonic rather than the Orthodox Christian tradition as to what the fall of man is. It is a falling into forgetfulness. Indeed, that is also so in the Genesis myth in the Garden of Eden, when Adam falls into a deep sleep. And in the sleep of Adam, Eve and the world of generation comes into being. And, of course, that is the same view told in other forms. So the function of the arts, and the city is built of all the arts, is to remind the forgetful soul. And of what, I wonder, do some of the products of our cities remind us? This is a great failure, that every true civilization should be built in the image of the imaginative archetypes and remind its inhabitants of those things which we all seek to remember and to recreate. Therefore, Golgonooza is called the city of human art and manufacture. It has mighty spires and domes of ivory and gold, embodying visions of the eternal world within that the sons of loss, the sons of the time spirit, labor to embody. Blake supremely admired Michelangelo and the other Florentine architects and painters who were with the builders of the Gothic cathedrals, which he also supremely loved and admired, working according to the true forms of the imagination, recognized by all because innate in all. He would himself have been glad to use his gifts in the service of his own city, London, as did the great architects and painters of the cities of Italy, and would have liked to make great frescoes comparable to theirs in Westminster Abbey, but he was never given the opportunity to do this. And Blake had never been to Italy. Many of his friends had. Flaxman went to Italy. He only knew Italy through engravings and so on. But for him, as for Yeats, Byzantium was the great city, the great realization and expression of the human imagination. So for Blake, Florence was, as for many of us, heaven knows, that city, though I think he would have felt now that Florence too has become a museum. He was bitter and angry in his protest against the commercial values of England, where money and not vision prevailed. He lamented the absence of such enlightened patrons as the papacy and the Medicis, who set the great Florentines to build and adorn the churches of Italy. And he wrote, "The artist wishes it was now the fashion to make such monuments, and then he should not doubt of having a national commission to execute these two pictures, the spiritual forms of Nelson and Pitt, that is, on a scale that is suitable to the grandeur of the nation, who is the parent of his heroes, in high finished fresco, where the colors would be as pure and as permanent as precious stones, though the figures were 100 feet in height." And he would have liked to make England what Italy is, an envied storehouse of intellectual riches. But a commercial nation, Blake protested, encourages impostors, since, of course, true discrimination is lacking and only money counts. However, scale being finally of little importance, it has surely come about that Blake's engravings of the Book of Job, a few square inches in size, are as universally known as Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. Did not Robert Frost make Adam say, "It's God I'd know him anywhere from William Blake"? And I think this is true, that all of us would, that for us the image of God is that marvellous figure of God appearing in the whirlwind to Blake, and the devil, the hypocritical God with his cloven foot, you know. We know that they have become part of the, not only the city of Gorgonosa, but the whole of the giant Albion. But the spiritual, the frontiers of the spiritual fourfold London extend to the four quarters of the earth. In eternity, so Blake tells us, the four arts, poetry, painting, music, and architecture, which is science, are the four faces of man. Not so in time and space. There, three are shut out, and only science remains through mercy. By means of science, the three become apparent in time and space, in the three professions, poetry and religion, music, law, painting in physic and surgery. What I take Blake to be saying, I don't know whether Dr. Dunbar would agree, because it may not be that this is quite what he meant, but it seems to me that what he is saying is that the activities of the imagination, poetry, painting, and music, whose values are intangible, are transposed into utilities in this world, in the three professions. You see, for Blake, religion was only, as it were, an externalization of poetry. For him, poetry, the prophetic spirit, the vision was primary, churches and doctrines and the whole iconography of religion are secondary. They are an externalization of the vision, which is the thing itself. So, in a way, therefore, for Blake, religion itself is one of the utilities. And this externalization is not itself to be regretted, although those who would carry the matter even further, dismissing from the city whatever is not of utilitarian value, are condemned by Blake, who remains himself a defender of the artist, who are in reality serving human souls in the most immediate way possible by enabling them to discover their own heights and depths, their own eternal nature. As it says in the Gospel, man does not live by bread alone, and we are living in a society lost that presumes that man does live by bread alone, but Blake knew that man lives by, spiritually, man lives by the arts, which are therefore not mere adornments of life, but of the deepest human necessity to us as human beings, and the profound dissatisfaction of the most materialist civilizations there have ever been bears witness to the sense of a lack which Blake labored to fulfill. So he describes how some of the sons of loss surround the passions with porches of iron and silver, creating form and beauty around the dark regions of sorrow, giving to airy nothing a name and a habitation delightful. Shakespeare, of course, gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name when he is describing the task of the poet. And Blake is there reminding us of Shakespeare, giving to airy nothing a name and a habitation delightful, with bounds to the infinite, putting off the indefinite into most holy forms of thought, such is the power of inspiration. They labor incessant with many tears and afflictions, creating the beautiful house for the piteous sufferer. Inspiration, of course, comes from within. We look at the archetype. We build the house. It's all in Plotinus on the beautiful. The temple exists in the mind of the architect, and then he just fits in the stones, you see. The real temple is a mental concept. One sees it in these marvelous Gothic churches. The church exists as a whole. The filling in, the chipping away of the stone is not the building of the church. It's the, as it were, the reflective of the pattern, and they labour incessantly with many tears and afflictions because it's no easy thing to build time in the image of eternity. And the beautiful house is created for we are these piteous passions and appetites of unrealized aspirations and desire, and we shall suffer until we have constructed for ourselves the objective correlatives of these human desires, and that is what a city is for, that is what we're for. Without such forms, without some objective correlative, the sufferers cannot free themselves from whatever inner torment we may be suffering, a fact which psychologists nowadays know only too well. Throughout all his descriptions of the labours of Loss and his sons, Blake insists on the toil, the great labours of the builders of Golgonooza, which indeed has its industrial zone, identified in terms of the human body with the stomach, reason is the head, feeling the heart, inspiration the lungs, but the labourers in the bowels of the city toil where Loss's anvils stand and his furnaces roar. And here I think there is a passage which is such a marvellous descriptive passage of the factory, the world of the of industry, that it certainly, although Blake is also speaking in symbolic terms, has its descriptive value. In Bowlahoola, which is the belly, as it were, of Albion or London, Loss's anvils stand and his furnaces rage. Thundering the hammers beat and the bellows blow loud, living, self-moving, mourning, lamenting and howling incessantly. Thousands and thousands labour. Thousands play on instruments, stringed or fluted, to ameliorate the sorrows of slavery. Loud sport the dancers in the dance of death, rejoicing in carnage. The hard, dentant hammers are lulled by the flutes, lula, lula. The bellowing furnaces blare by the long-sounding clarion. The double drum drowns howls and groans. The shrill fife shrieks and cries. The crooked horn mellows the hoarse, raving serpent, terrible but harmonious. As a piece of English metrics, of course, it's wonderful, you know, and the use of the consonants, and one could give a whole morning seeing how it's done, but it is this, it produces a scene worthy of Wagner's music to the Nibelungs. But while the daughters of Enitharmon are at their task of clothing the souls who come into the world with lovely heavens, and while the sons of Los labour at the furnaces, in the fury of poetic inspiration to build the universe stupendous, mental forms creating, the daughters of Vala, the terrible goddess Nature, the principle of mortal generation opposed to Jerusalem, who is the mother of souls, weaves what Blake calls the black woof of death, as the veil of human miseries is woven over the ocean. The ocean is the sea of time and space, the time world of that single means. And we must now consider the city as humanity built, when the agent is not the imagination of the human spirit, but the empirical ego of natural, unspiritual man, whom Blake calls, in distinction from the divine humanity, the human imagination, Satan, the mind of the natural frame. The satanic city built by natural man, the worm of 60 winters, the worm of 70 inches long, as Blake says, without imagination, without the vision of the archetype of the human spirit, recalls Dante's city of Dis, built in the darkness of hell, which is by definition that state cut off from God. Milton too had his city of Pandemonium, again an imposing work built by the fallen angels. Both Dis and Pandemonium, for all their mighty structures, are places only of sorrow and alienation. They have no existence in eternity and are but the ruins of time. There is much of Milton's Pandemonium in the city of Blake's Satan, which is, of course, also a state of being, human, as Jerusalem, the holy city, is also a human state. I also stood in Satan's bosom and beheld its desolations, a ruined man, a ruined building of God not made with hands, its plains of burning sand, its mountains of marble terrible, its pits and declivities flowing with molten ore and fountains of pitch and mitre, its ruined palaces and cities and mighty works, its furnaces of affliction, in which his angels of emanations labour with blackened visages among its stupendous ruins, arches and pyramids and porches, colonnades and domes. The landscape of hell is always strikingly contemporary, whether it's Milton's Pandemonium with its technological marvels, or Piranesi's prisons, marvels of engineering, or that dull red glow in the sky over Dante's City of Dis, which seems like a prophecy of the modern industrial city with its glow of furnaces. No phrase of Blake's is better known than those dark satanic mills, and it puzzled the French terribly. I had a volume of my papers translated into French by different hands. I think there were 7 different translations of dark satanic mills, but the French simply could not get this combination of usine, or fabrique, which is a factory, and a mill, which is a mechanism, which of course are both implicit in Blake's marvellous image of mills, which are at once factories and the mechanism in which which works in them. Perhaps because France didn't have its industrial revolution at that time, it had certainly topped the translation, and is something so essentially part of the English landscape and the English ideology. Well, the phrase, which of us has not felt that those words are the most apt description of the landscape of England's industrial revolution? But what is less well known, or well received for that matter, is that these words do not in fact describe the mills and factories of an industrial landscape, which indeed in Blake's lifetime had only begun to appear, but the philosophy, the ideology, which gave rise to these. That mechanistic materialism of post-Cartesian science, which Blake identified by those names he associated with this deadly ideology, Bacon, Newton, and Locke, philosopher of the Newtonian system and father of modern behaviorism, the last outrage of a mechanistic ideology which sees the universe as a clock, as a machine, and ends by seeing man himself as also a mechanism. This is the philosophy of the empirical ego, opaque to the imaginative vision of the true man, the human spirit, and basing all knowledge on the data presented by the 5 senses. Therefore, Blake calls Satan the limit of opacity, and Adam, the natural man, the limit of contraction. They are minimal humanity, beneath which the divine mercy has nevertheless made it impossible to fall. The statue of our true humanity is the reach of the imagination throughout the 4 regions or universes opened to us by the 4 azures. And sense, according to Blake, is the eye of imagination, a definition far removed from that of the mechanists, who see only a passive response to stimuli from an external and lifeless universe in an organism itself, a minimal part of that mechanism. This narrow and dark mentality was already widespread before the industrial landscape was built in its image by the application of its principles, setting men and women and children to become the slaves of machines, until, as Blake said of England, the giant Albion, his machines are woven with his life. And they are indeed, and while our modern machines have become more subtle, more complex, they are no less deadly to the human spirit in the forms of computers, which people increasingly feel to be taking over even the functions of human thought, so that man himself is being continually diminished by this mechanized universe, which is a kind of idolatry created by what Blake proclaimed with all his prophetic genius to be a false mentality, a mistake, a total error. The mills of Satan are the universe of mechanistic causes, ever producing mechanistic effects, unmitigated, unenlightened by any vision of humanity's inner kingdom, the archetype which the citizens of Golgonooza ever labor to realize. And therefore Blake calls Satan the miller of eternity, and with a direct allusion to the Newtonian astronomy, prince of the starry hosts and of the wheels of heaven, to turn the mills day and night. Blake leaves us in no doubt what the ideology is which he holds responsible for this mechanistic mentality, soon to image itself in the factories of 19th century utilitarian England, thence to spread all over the world, taking with it desolation. He asks Satan, "Art thou not Newton's Pantocrator, weaving the woof of Locke? To mortals thy mills seem everything." And Lowth dismisses Satan with the words, "Thy work is eternal death with mills and ovens and cauldrons. Trouble me no more, thou canst not have eternal life." There would be little point in my presence here as Blake's spokesman if it were merely a matter of the history of ideas, safely isolated from the present as something over and done with, belonging to the ignorant past. But on the contrary, whereas scientists themselves have meanwhile advanced into a universe very different from that mechanistic hell, our society is still in the power of our machines, our computers and mechanical brains and all the rest, our humanity enslaved to these idols we ourselves have created, with dire consequences. For, again in Blake's words, what seems to be is for those to whom it seems to be. So as Blake listened to the voices of London, he heard much that was terrible. Conscription of men for the cannon fodder of war, industrial enslavement of women and children. At Tyburn, hangings of mere boys for small offences against property. All the sufferings and injustices of the society from which Jerusalem, the soul of the nation, is cast forth. Upon the wilds of Poplar and Bow, to Malden and Canterbury, in the delights of cruelty. The shuttles of death sing in the sky to Islington and Pancras, round Marybone to Tyburn's river, weaving black melancholy as a net, and despair as meshes closely wove over the west of London, where mild Jerusalem sought to repose in death and be no more. But Jerusalem found refuge in the humble home of Blake and his wife Catherine in Lambeth. There it was that Blake's own earliest prophetic books were written, a house of hope and the love of the early years of marriage. And that is why Jerusalem fled to Lambeth's mild vale and hid herself beneath the Surrey hills. Her sons are seized for victims of sacrifice, but Jerusalem cannot be found, hid by the daughters of Beulah being married love. And there follows a beautiful and intimate image of the relationship of Blake and his wife, who gave refuge to Jerusalem in a hostile world. There is a grain of sand in Lambeth that Satan cannot find, nor can his watch fiends find it. It is translucent and has many angles, but he who finds it will find Uthum's palace, or within, opening into Beulah. Every angle is a love of heaven. Uthun's palace, the secret palace of love, opening into Beulah, into the love of marriage, the feminine world of tenderness. The building of Blake's Jerusalem was in Lambeth, in the secrecy of love and the poet's self-imposed prophetic task. We builded Jerusalem as a city and a temple. From Lambeth we began our foundations, lovely Lambeth, O lovely hills of Camberwell. One wouldn't perhaps see it in that way quite, but there it is. The beauty is within. The sole object of all the labours of Golgonooza, ever building, ever falling, is to provide an earthly habitation for Jerusalem, the bride of Jesus, the imagination, the soul who loves and receives, and is the mother of the divine human present within every individual as the image of God, as man was created according to the first chapter of Genesis. And it is always to Lambeth that Blake returns in thought, Lambeth's vale, where Jerusalem's foundations began. And he asks, when shall Jerusalem return and overspread all the nations? Return, return to Lambeth's vale, O building of human souls. And this is Blake's final word on the city, the golden builders of Jerusalem. What are those golden builders doing? Where was the burying place of soft Athinthus, near Tyburn's fatal tree? Is that mild Zion's hills, most ancient promontory, near mournful ebb of weeping Paddington? Is that Calvary and Golgotha, becoming a building of pity and compassion? Lo, the stones are pity, and the bricks, well-wrought affections, enameled with love and kindness, and the tiles in graven gold, labour of merciful hands. The beams and rafters of forgiveness, the mortar and cement of the work, tears of honesty, the nails and the screws of, and iron braces are well-wrought blandishments and well-contrived words, firm fixing, never forgotten, always comforting the remembrance, the floors, humility, the ceilings, devotion, the hearths, thanksgiving. Prepare the furniture, O Lambeth, in thy pitying looms, the curtains woven of tears and sighs, wrought into lovely forms for comfort. There the secret furniture of Jerusalem's chamber is wrought. Lambeth, the bride, the Lamb's wife, loveth thee. Thou art one with her, and knowest not self in thy supreme joy. Go on, builders in hope, though Jerusalem wanders far away, without the gate of loss, among the dark satanic wheels. And then, it's a good place to stop, I think.
Thank you very much indeed, Kathleen Ray. And thank you particularly for bringing Blake's hidden city out into the light. In other words, for presenting us with such a positive vision of his view of the city. I'm sure if he had visited Coventry, then he would have described that too as a human, awful wonder of God.
It's a wonderful description.
It is. I was hoping very much to finish with a spirited discussion, but I think in view of the rather satanic interruption, which I'd also like to apologise, we'd better leave things there. But thank you very much indeed for coming and talking to us. So
I wish we could have had a discussion. I'm very, very sorry to have gone on so long and too long.
It was most interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.